Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. About 17 years ago, a friend of mine at the time was talking about his son. His son, Ed Jr., I speak of, Sergeant, former Sergeant in the New York City Police Department, Ed Burns, and he was telling me that my guest in studio was, I forget what the expression was, but he putting together a movie, and he's an actor. He's everything. He's producing. He's directing. He's okay. That's good. And he said, "You got to put him on." And I said, "Sure." We spoke, and as I welcome actor, director, film producer, writer Ed Burns, 17 years, long, long time.
Long, long time.
But the movie, the one that your father was referring to, became a sensation, particularly in the Irish American community. And I remember at the time recommending my audience to my audience that they should go and see your movie, the MacMillan brothers, and many of them said it is laced with F words and with everything else. What are you doing to us? But let me tell you, it was something. Just tell us about how you came up with the notion of the Brothers MacMillan.
I was out of film school, writing screenplays, trying to break into the business. And I probably wrote 6 or 7 screenplays, sent them out to Hollywood, and got no traction, nothing but rejection letters back. And I was writing in whatever genre I thought would sell. I wasn't writing personal films. And at about that time, a number of young filmmakers started to make these extremely low-budget independent films. And the films were then getting picked up for distribution. And these movies were made for $25,000, $50,000. And these filmmakers then got a career. They got an opportunity to get into the business and make their next film. So I looked at them, and they were making personal films, and I thought, well, you know what, that's got to be my ticket in. I want to be a writer-director. I've got to sit down and figure out what kind of film can I make for $25,000. I was also a big Woody Allen fan, a Scorsese fan, a Spike Lee fan, and I looked at what those guys were doing. You know, Spike was covering the African-American New York experience, Scorsese, the Italian-American New York experience, Woody, the Jewish American New York experience. And I thought, well, what about the Irish? You know, why don't we have our voice? The other thing was I wasn't seeing any films that where the characters sounded like the way me and my buddies spoke to one another. And I thought, all right, well, there's two pockets there that feel underrepresented. So with those two thoughts in mind, I sat down and I knew the one location I could have access to for free for as long as possible was my parents' house in Valley Stream. So I thought, all right, I'm going to have three brothers living in that house. And from there, I sat down and wrote a screenplay that we shot for $25,000. And as you said, my old man was my biggest supporter and financed it. And we got to Sundance, and it sold. And
amazing.
It was a wild, wild ride.
You were born in Woodside, Queens.
Yes.
Okay, let's say a typical Irish Catholic family, middle class family. Tell us what the atmosphere was like. Where did you go to school? Where did you?
So I was born in Woodside. We stayed there for about 3 years, and then we moved to Valley Stream, Long Island. And Valley Stream, sort of. Typical working-class Long Island neighborhood, all Irish and Italian. You know, I was one of three, but plenty of big families. You know, the Dugans had 9, the Daltons had 10. And of my gang of friends, you know, the 8 of us, 5 of them, I had friends whose parents were off the boat. So, you know, you'd go into the Harton's house, and Mrs. Harton had, you know, Deirdre and Patricia practicing their Irish step dancing. You know, you go to the O'Rourke's, and Mrs. O'Rourke spoke with a brogue and was making Irish soda bread. And that was sort of, that's what these, you know, living rooms and kitchens felt like. But for us, all the kids, nobody wanted any part of that. You know, we were young American kids who were more interested in rock and roll and the Yankees. So it wasn't until we hit our later teens that you started to get that you started to own your Irish identity a little bit more and wear it as a badge of honor, as did the Italian kids. And we would, you know.
Did you get along with the Italian kids? What was the common?
Oh yeah, there was we all went to the same Catholic schools, and it was funny, you know, that the houses were essentially the same. Small houses, lots of kids, everybody screaming and yelling, everybody, you know, a different kind of crazy.
Were there many of your ilk who actually, you know, decided to be to choose a career that, to be honest, at that time was considered to be fairly tough? Writing screenplays, whatever. There wasn't
no, oh, no, no, no. I was the only one.
The Lone Ranger.
You know, and as a kid, even as a kid in high school, I never mentioned to my friends that I had this dream that one day I might be a writer. You know, my filmmaking dream wasn't born until I was in college. But in high school, I knew that I wanted to write. And that was something that, you know, my friends would have made fun of me and mocked me for.
Right.
You know, all in good fun, but... we didn't know anyone who was in the arts at all. But fortunately, you know, my dad, because of his relationships, at about, I don't know if I was 16, 17, we started to be exposed to some other folks and brought into Manhattan. And, you know, when he saw that I had an interest in writing, he and my mom were the ones that sort of pushed me in that direction and said, you know, look, your dreams are going to come true across the river, so get the hell out of Valley Stream.
Yeah. So they were more than fully supportive.
Oh, yeah.
Helps.
It absolutely does.
Was there music in your own house? I know you've described quite well about the neighborhood and whatever, but was there a musical tendency in the house?
You know, I mean, it's my mom sort of listened to everything. You know, the popular music at the time was a big Frank Sinatra fan.
Right.
We also had, you know, the Clancy Brothers playing in the house periodically. Not a lot, but, you know, I do remember that LP in the, you know, on the turntable in our dining room. So.
Yeah. And your dad was very active in the police department, both, you know, again, as a sergeant, but he was also a spokesperson for the police department and had, again, very much to the forefront. Anybody who knew him at, you know, during those years also knew he was a force to be reckoned with. He had very strong opinions.
Yeah. No, and he always did. When he worked down at DCPI, the Office of Public Information, he was the spokesperson, and he was the voice of the PD when all the journalists would call and find out, okay, there's a homicide up on, you know, 125 and whatever. You know, he was the guy who sort of gave the statement that the police wanted to get out. And through that, my understanding is, you know, he became very good friends with a lot of those journalists. I'm sure guys that you've met with him.
Yeah.
And I think those relationships were a big part of his encouraging me to pursue my writing. I think he looked at that lifestyle and thought, hey, you know what, this is If this is something you have some talent for and some interest in, let's go for it.
Yeah,
and
let's go.
It was through those relationships that he got me my very first job. While I was still at Hunter College up on 68th and Lex,
right.
He got me a job on the assignment desk at the 7 o'clock news for Channel 5.
Uh-huh.
And that was just a favor. And back then, everything was done with favors.
Sure. Now, some 17 years ago, we were talking about 95, $25,000was basically, that didn't leave you, there was no wiggle room there. How did you attract actors? How did you... I can't, no matter what way you slice it, there wasn't enough money there for God's sake for, you know.
We put
the cameraman, the film, Did you wind up owing? Was there an understanding?
We got the movie in the can for 25. We ended up owing probably another 50 to the lab that processes the film. After we sold the film, we were able to pay off that debt. But and it's one of those things that I don't know if I would have done it if I wasn't 25 years old and didn't know any better. We put an ad in Backstage Magazine, which is the actor's rag here in town, and basically said, you know, non-union, low-budget movie looking for, you know, Irish-American guys and gals, no pay, but we'll feed you lunch. And I got almost 2,000 headshots, and I cast an entire cast off of those headshots. We worked with a, you know, 4-5-man crew. No one got paid. We all just worked for deferred pay. I had to re-enroll in college for one class in order to get the student discount to buy the film stock. All of our equipment was old and used, and you know, we just begged and borrowed. You know, every location we got for free. You know, if you look back at the film, all of these couples, you know, when they go on dates, they don't go to restaurants or go to the movie. They take a walk through the park. The reason is you can shoot for free in the park and you don't need any lights.
Yeah. Your the success of that movie would lead to a more successful career and take you out of the Irish American scene. What was it after your first movie? What was the draw? And now you have gone from actor, film producer, writer, director, the whole job lot, to being sought after as a serious actor, number one?
Yeah. You know, after my first couple of movies, after McMullen and that movie, She's the One That Followed It,
right.
I started to get offers to act in Hollywood films. And quite honestly, I had no interest in that career, partially because I didn't really have enough confidence to think that I could do it. I had acted in my two small films, and I knew how I could manipulate my performances in the editing room. But my agents came to me and said, if you're going to continue to act in your small films, you should go off and act in Hollywood films, because if you become a bigger star, it will make it that much easier to get your small films financed. And that seemed to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I then started to look at screenplays. And one of the first that I got was Saving Private Ryan. And they had asked me to take a look at the part of the sergeant, which Tom Sizemore eventually played.
Right.
But when I read the script, there was the part of Ryben, who was the wise ass from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, the Sarge has to do some real acting. Not that I didn't have to do real acting in Private Ryan, but I just felt, you know, the smart aleck kid from Brooklyn is a little bit more in my wheelhouse. So I put myself in for that one. And somehow, miraculously, Spielberg had seen Brothers McMullen and said, that's, you know, you're who I want. Yeah. Then once Private Ryan happens, well, you can imagine your life changes.
Sure.
I mean, McMullen changed my life pretty dramatically. Then Ryan, 2 years later, put me on a whole other sphere.
Absolutely. It also puts you into a spotlight, something that you wouldn't have been used to from Woodside or...
Yeah. Certainly.
Or Valley Stream or whatever. What was that adjustment like?
You know, I think, like any 29-year-old kid who goes through that, I was probably running around a little bit more than I would have normally, having a great time and glad that I, you know, did it all. It certainly took my focus off of my filmmaking, and for a couple of years there, not only did I not make a film, I didn't even write a screenplay. I had moved out to Los Angeles. My agents were telling me, you know, we're going to turn you into a movie star. But I lasted for about 2 years out in L.A. I did this movie. The second film I did after that was a movie called 15 Minutes with Robert De Niro. And we started that production in Los Angeles and finished in New York in the summer. And being back home in New York that summer, I kind of knew I had missed my hometown. I wanted to stay there. And then made a conscious effort to sort of get back to filmmaking. And I think part of it was, you know, I've stayed very close to my folks. I have a great relationship with my parents and my friends. And, you know, I'd like to think I'm grounded. And I think it's because of that. And a big part of it, I think, was moving back to New York.
Now, when you, you know, when you speak of, say, Robert De Niro and, you know, developing a relationship there, did you get a feeling that you were one of many in the sense that somebody of his character, of his stature, you know, wouldn't, you know, be focusing particularly on you, but rather, you know, a group of actors? What kind of fellow is he?
De Niro was, I mean, that was one of my great experiences, and I still have a great relationship with him and a friendship with him. And I've been involved with the Tribeca Film Festival since day one because of that relationship we have. You know, very generous actor, you know, was totally open to me asking him not only sort of the bigger questions about career navigation, but then also asking about, okay, on the set of, you know, Taxi Driver, what was it like to shoot this scene? What, you know, what does Scorsese do as a filmmaker? And he was totally open with all of those things.
Were you at that point, when did you actually start getting the big bucks? We'd have to assume that Saving Private Ryan, that was a huge step. What influence did the money have, and the outrageous money compared to, you know, some other...
To my dad's salary? That NYPD salary?
To 20 of our salaries.
Oh, yeah.
Did that have an effect? Did that have... was that something you said, God, for the money I want to stay here, this, I'm not going to do this well financially anywhere else?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I look at my resume, my acting resume, and I you can almost point out the choices that I made for the money. And and you know, I'm very lucky. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with that, because what those choices allow me to do is they give me sort of a financial flexibility or freedom to continue to make these small movies. As far as a life change, I mean, you know, you just feel blessed that, you know, you've been able to make a lot of money and, you know, share it with your family.
Right.
So it's...
Did you see yourself as being a settled husband, a father? You're nearly back to where you started, in the sense that you're back in that cocoon again.
Yeah.
And I say that with all due respect. But did you see that during, say, the couple of years you were out in Los Angeles, or did you say, hey, life is good, let me do a bit more of this?
Yeah, I think I fully expected that one day I was going to get married and have children. I absolutely wanted that. And I also wanted it before I wanted to do it while I was still a relatively young guy, because I'm a very participant father, and, you know, I was a jock, and my dad coached my little league team and my basketball team, and, you know, I want to do the same things with my kids. And so I knew, look, I'm totally, I want to embrace this chapter, and and have fun, but I always knew that at a certain point I would want to settle down.
What age are your kids now?
9 and 6.
Okay. Did they, as kids, at what point did they get to realize, boy, you know, my dad's a big actor, and so is my mother, and, you know, considered, and a reading that the mother is one of the most beautiful women in the world. Did they kind of wake up one day and say, "Hey, I'm pretty special here. Maybe I can stretch some of the privileges that one in my position should have."
Yeah, no. I mean, I think, you know, part of what attracted Christy and I to one another is that we're both very grounded. She's very close with her mom. I'm close with my folks. And we try and instill in them as much as we can, given that our lives are very different from the way we grew up.
Right.
But we try and recreate that environment. That said, a couple of years ago, my daughter started to recognize that, you know, people might come up to us in a restaurant and, you know, so she's aware of, I guess, what we do for a living. My son, a very funny story about him from just a couple of months ago. Saving Private Ryan was on television.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he kind of knows that I'm in the movie business, but he doesn't really give it any thought. He's 6 years old. So I'm flicking through the channels. I see Private Ryan is on, and it's not one of the violent scenes. It's a dialogue scene. So I flick back to it. And Barry Pepper, one of the actors, comes on screen. So I say, "Hey, Finn, do you know that guy?" He says, "No." And then it goes to a shot of Adam Goldberg. I say, "Hey, you know that guy?" He says, "No." And then it comes to my shot. I say, "Hey, you know that guy?" And he does a double take. He says, "Oh, my God, Dad, you were in the Army?" So he's more impressed with the fact that if
the
I was
uniform.
In the Army, I'd be a real hero,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, the uniform got to him.
So.
So you've had all of this time and the variety of movies, the different genre. What brought about your now your own new movie, one which is just being rolled out now, The Fitzgerald Family Christmas, it is being directed by your good self, and you feature in it. Took you a long time, actually, to do the whole circle and come back to your Narrowback roots again. And not only that, but to gather the crew from the Brothers McMullen, many of whom we have to assume had gone their own separate ways.
Yeah. You know, it was a couple of things. I think I was hesitant to go back just because sort of what we've been talking about, my life had changed so dramatically that I just wondered, could I write about that place or that world, if you will, with the same kind of authenticity? And the other thing that happens is, you know, as my life changed and, you know, you're experiencing these new things, you mm-hmm. want to explore those as a writer. But I was working in a film a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, with Tyler Perry. And Tyler had just rewatched Brothers McMullen. And he basically said to me, he's like, "Look, your first two movies were so successful. I don't understand why in 15 years you've never gone back to that Irish-American milieu." Mm. He goes, "Look at what I do. I super serve my niche." He goes, "Go make another movie for the audience that loved those first two movies. And I guarantee you, you know, you're going to have a hit on your hands." And the minute he said it, I kind of knew he was right. And it felt like it was the right time. And I sat down and I just started to write. I kind of had two notions in my head. I had this idea of a character who ends up having to become the patriarch of his clan after the father has sort of abandoned the family. And I also knew that I wanted to make a film about a big family. You know, I'm one of three, but as I mentioned,
right.
You know, one of my best friends is one of nine, and I have a friend who's one of 12. And always hearing about what it was like to grow up in those homes, I thought, all right, that's where I'm going to start. And I was pleasantly surprised. You know, I mean, it was the most fun I've had writing a screenplay in years, because I didn't still know the characters really well, and I knew the voices, and they were distinct. And normally a first draft takes me 6 months, and this took me 6 weeks.
Did you have I know you've built, did some of those characters fall into the category of saying, you know, I'm going to get in touch with some of my original colleagues, particularly the ones who, you know, perhaps haven't had the success that you've had, and I'm going to, you know, let me have a bit of the character that I know them for. Does
absolutely.
Any of that play in?
Yeah, absolutely. Once I started to write the script, I started to think about who I was going to cast in it. And I started to think about two actors that I've been working with in the last couple of films, Caitlin Fitzgerald and another woman named Carrie Bechet. And then I started to think about Mike McGlone for the part of Quinn. And I called up Mike and I told him what I was working on. And he read the script and he immediately said, I'm in. So then I said, all right, this film is about a family getting back together. So why don't I do the same thing with my filmmaking family? I've made 10 films now. And I looked at the cast list of every film, and I went down the line and said, we've got to cast an actor from each film I've made. So, you know, when we looked at She's the One, Anita Gillette played Jennifer Aniston's mom. Malachi McCourt played McGlone's driver in there. I called both of them up. We got them on board. And the cast was pretty much done, with the exception of the, you know, my character's love interest. Right. And Connie Britton, who was also in Brothers McMullen, who's gone on to, you know, more success than any of us. She's very busy now, but I thought, you know, Connie would be sort of the, you know, the final jewel in this crown. So why don't I give her a buzz and see if she's available? And she said, send me the script. She read it. She loved it. And said, I'll make myself available. And that was it. And the great thing that happened is, you know, you pull all these people together who I've known for, some of them 18 years. They've known each other for a long time. We've all worked together. You start rolling the camera on them, and there's an immediate sense of history that they're bringing to the scene because they do have these long relationships. And when you have, you know, seven actors who you're supposed to buy as siblings, that helps.
Right. Is there a tendency when you are writing, particularly after you're writing, you're directing, you're producing, you're filmmaking, you're acting after all these years, when you want to come back to your Irish American roots, is there a tendency to say, oh, gee, I better, this time I have to kind of stay away from the stereotype and, you know, and the drinking and the, well, again, the image, does that have to be a conscious, or do you just let it flow?
A little bit of both, quite honestly. You know, when I look back on Brothers McMullen, I see the young writer who wanted to make sure, especially when I had made the decision, I'm going to make this an Irish-American film. You know, I mean, in every scene, they're either wearing a Notre Dame T-shirt or there's an Irish flag in the background.
Right.
I needed to hit you over the head with the fact that they're Irish. In this film, you know, 17 years later, I think I'm a better writer, better filmmaker. You know, they're Irish in name and in sort of subtext, maybe. They're certainly Catholic, and that's a big part of it. You know, Rosie, the mom, makes a little joke about the English. For some of the old-timers, when we've done the Q&As, they seem to really appreciate that joke. But then there's also, you know, the idea that you want to paint a realistic picture of an Irish-American family. And there are some things that, quite honestly, you know, they're not even specific to the Irish-American experience.
Right.
You know, whether it's addiction issues or, you know, a dad who bails on the family or whatever the things might be. I mean, the thing that
Is it more, do you think blue-collar, do you think middle class, do you think, you know, a bit of Woodside, Valley Stream, or has some of the other influences along the way, have they kind of taken over some of those areas?
What I try to do with this is, you know, when I write, I always environment is a big part. Like, if I can't visualize the world in a real way, I have a tough time sort of owning the scene when I'm writing it. So I imagine that the Fitzgeralds grew up in the house I grew up in Ballastream. And as I thought about, you know, those seven siblings, and I think about my friends, especially the, you know, the bigger families, the kids go out and they end up in all different sort of socioeconomic places. You know, you've got the, and this film reflects that, you know, there's the second youngest daughter is in Manhattan trying to make a go at an acting career. The third daughter is a nurse who married a guy who's, you know, a working class guy who's not doing so well. The oldest daughter married a very successful guy who went to Fordham, and they live in a big, beautiful house in Garden City. So I tried to sort of take a look at, you know, as wide a range of the, that Irish American experience that I witnessed on Long Island.
What role does the Catholicism play now, 17 years later?
Less so. I mean, there's a subplot in the movie where one of the sisters is married a Jewish guy, and he's an atheist, and the daughter Erin has walked away from the church, so she doesn't want to baptize the kid. But of course, the grandmother Rosie wants the kid baptized, so she comes up with a plan to sneak the kid off when she's babysitting to take him up to church to have Malachi McCourt baptize the child. So, you know, there's Catholicism certainly plays a part in it, but I think the bigger thing where Catholicism comes in is, you know, there's a story about a guy who walked out on his family 20 years ago and never looked back. And the big theme of the film is a theme of forgiveness. And that is the constant debate throughout, and whether or not we should forgive. And if Catholicism plays any role in the storytelling of this, it's those thoughts and you know, how important forgiveness is, even when arguably this guy really didn't deserve it.
Okay, so now it's the Fitzgerald family Christmas, and we have to assume that the whole notion of this was not simply because we were coming into the Christmas season, but rather it was, again, it's cast, it's part of your writing, it's part of you imagined that, you know, Christmas is a time, if there was a wayward father who had been out of the scene for so many years, Christmas would be a good time. So does that kick in very early?
Yeah, I mean, what I needed was, when I had this idea of seven siblings and the wayward father, I needed the device of how do I get seven adults under one roof. And I knew that I wanted each character to be going through something in their life. Each character should have an arc and have to change during the course of the storytelling. So I needed a device in order to make that plausible. And I thought Christmas would be the most obvious and easiest one, given that, as you said, that would be the moment when the father would return home. But it would also be the time when, you know, I know I announced to my family that I was, you know, about to propose to Christy on Christmas Eve. And that's when folks say, all right, we're going to have a baby. Or guess what? We're getting divorced or separated. So I knew that everything comes to a head during the holidays, and there's a lot of pressure to have a good time, and you are all thrust together. So as a storytelling device, I knew that it worked. But then the other thing, you know, and it's something when you're writing, you never think theme first. You're going to tell a story, and then the theme presents itself. And when the theme of forgiveness presented itself, I knew that it was a nice tie-in to Christmas.
There is also an aspect, of course, as you know, you're talking about forgiveness. You're also talking about something that many of us could relate to, and that is that, you know, this diligent mother who had to bring up these kids, and your man doesn't care one way or the other, or he's off and about, that the reality of that is that whereas there may have been, you know, maybe there are, you know, mixed emotions with, you know, the return, you know, of King Tut at this stage of the game, that there is the bitterness, the anger, that all of the things, that all the emotions, which must be very part of the fabric of this mother, who didn't have the luxury and rarely does of saying "I'm out of here," that's very real too. Was that, did that kick in early? In I know you're saying you know with respect to the team, but she plays a much bigger role than we're giving, you know. Yeah.
I mean, she held down the fort all those years, and the movie hangs on her decision. You know, she will have the last word on whether or not he's will be invited back. And you talk about, you know, there is a lot of anger and a lot of bitterness, and all, you know, she has every right to own every bit of it. You know, that's one of those things where I, quite honestly, I don't know where that came from in the writing. You know, I mean, part of the, you know, you hear songwriters and musicians talk all the time about, you know, something. I don't know where that melody came from.
Right.
She is the hero of this tale. I wish I knew. I mean, I have a great relationship with my mom. I know a lot of strong mothers. I really don't have any relationship with a woman that had to do this.
Right.
So I don't really know where she came from.
The notion also that this is, whereas it is the, you know, Fitzgerald family Christmas, the extended family, the relationships, all of that is very real, and I suppose that's also going to make it all the more interesting. You know, this is not simply the family itself. It's now has very little resemblance to, you know, the family that started off when the father walks out the door.
Yeah, well, I knew that I wanted the last scene of the film to be just the immediate family back mm-hmm. there having Christmas dinner together. And I didn't want any of the spouses to be there, any of the boyfriends or girlfriends or husbands or wives, or even any of the children. So the writing was a little tricky on how I was going to come up with that.
And how are you going to get rid of them?
How am I going to get rid of them? and I think we found good devices to do it, and it all feels believable. But, you know, the one thing that I tried to do, and this was something that I kind of hit on pretty early, was, you know, what was the one thing, and this sort of talks to sort of their dysfunction in their external relationships that they all have, you know, and even, I guess, relates back home. The one thing that the old man passed on to them was selfishness. You know, in the beginning of the movie, they can't find time for one another, for their mother. And they all, you know, that was the great wound that he inflicted on them.
Does a lot of this kind of hit a bit close to the bone?
No. You know, I mean, I... Not
for you, but for those who are going to watch this movie and say, hey.
Oh, yeah, no, it's, we've, you know, taken it out to film festivals, and it's been out digitally now on iTunes
right.
and VOD for about a week. Hearing back from people, I get two things. I get a lot of Irish Americans saying, all right, that's a little weird. You must have been peeking through our kitchen window last Christmas.
Right.
Or other people saying, you know, I'm not Irish, I'm not Catholic, but this is my family. I had a decision when I was writing the script about when I wrote the scene where I have that scene with the dad and he mm-hmm. drops the bombshell on me. Which way do I want to go with the screenplay? Tonally. Do I want to tell, you know, a funny, light, romantic, hey, it's a big, crazy Irish family at Christmas
right.
time? Or did I want to tell a more serious, dramatic, heartfelt, tougher journey And mm-hmm. You know, my favorite Christmas film is It's a Wonderful Life. Right. And I thought about, you know, what George Bailey has to go through. Mm. He goes through a lot of tough stuff, but when you get to the end for that heartfelt payoff, it's earned. And I think that's why we go back to that movie time and time again. So not to compare this right. to that, but I was trying to write something hopefully with the same kind of gravitas.
That's a bit closer to home and today and the release of your movie. I'm going to ask you about that digital movie stuff in a couple of minutes because I won't have much to say while they're telling us what that's about. The Hurricane Sandy, you growing up, all of us growing up, and imagining what it must be like, you know, for a tsunami somewhere, for, you know, Katrina, for, you know, for this terrible type disaster that happens somewhere. And then to have the experience of saying, wait a minute, for New York, you got to be kidding me. New Jersey, the capital of the world, and this should happen to us. What kind of backlash, what kind of feeling do you get, your family gets? How close did it affect a lot of your family and friends?
Well, I know, you know, my immediate family, two cousins live out in Long Beach, Long Island, and both of them...
As my daughter does.
Yeah, and, you know, they had to go stay with my sister and stay at my parents' house in Rockville Center. Finally now back in their homes. You know, my folks have some friends in Breezy. Fortunately, their houses were spared. And, you know, my dad spent his summers in the Rockaways on Beach 101st Street. And he just drove by on his way to the airport, and the bungalow is still there. But, you know, there's no way... you know, as a New Yorker, you're connected to someone who was affected by this tragedy.
Right. Almost like 9/11.
Absolutely.
In the sense that this is another shocker, and this is one, again, that has a tremendous sense of destruction, of sorrow, of regret, and of uncertainty. You know, even for those who are, you know, back and rebuilding and everything, it casts a whole other light on life and the uncertainty of life.
Yeah.
Now, would you air explain this digital film and whatever? We know, you know, what you can do with $25,000 17 years ago. Now, what is digital film? How is this going to come about?
All right. So what a lot of independent films have been doing now has sort of changed the way they release films in order to reach as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. Indie film theaters don't exist in the same numbers that they used to. Folks are sitting home in their living rooms and watching their favorite shows on demand. So now you've started to see indie films follow suit. So anyone who's got cable television is familiar with their Movies on Demand channel. Mm-hmm. You would just go in there, and under new movies or new releases, you'll find the Fitzgerald's Family Christmas. A lot of folks now watch movies on iTunes and Amazon, so the movie's available there. On December 7th, the movie opens up theatrically. New York, Long Island, I think we're in Florida, Boston, Chicago. A couple other towns I might be forgetting, and then on the 14th expands a little wider.
How does that work? You're dealing here with somebody who would say, well, why would you do this and then expect that this will be a huge success in theaters across the nation, which for novices like myself, that's the real goal. How many bodies do you get to come out and go in, and you know how many millions you can make, and how do you get into the top? How do you do that with this new digital format? Like we
Well, what we've discovered is it seems to be two separate audiences. They don't cannibalize one another. You know, these smaller, independent, specialized movies, you know, they're going to open up in, you know, their art houses. So if you live in an urban area, you have an art house close by, and we'll be in a lot of those theaters, and that audience will show up. But if you live in the suburbs, a lot of times, you know, there isn't an indie movie house anywhere near you. And in the past, that audience used to have to wait for the movie to show up on DVD.
Right.
But what everyone has discovered is, you know, for these last 2 weeks and for 2 weeks moving forward, I'm doing a ton of press every day, as is my cast. So folks hear about it, and this is an audience now that wants what they want when they want it.
And,
so someone listening to this interview can go right onto iTunes or Movies On Demand and buy the movie tonight.
Right.
Whereas before, they might have to wait the 3 weeks for it to show up.
And indeed, not only the 3 weeks, but in many of the movies and a lot of, you know, very successful movies, they never got into pockets. Again, some of them few short miles. I mean, you may be able to catch it in New York City, but waiting for something to hit a theater. So is that the way everything is going? Is there going to be a balance somewhere along the way here? Will theaters always make it?
I think theaters will always make it, but I think most people are going to the theaters now for the bigger movie. They go for the spectacle. So your big sci-fi thriller, a movie like The Avengers, also bigger broad comedies work because it's fun to sit in an audience and feel that infectious laughter. Horror movies still work because, you know, kids like to get together and scream. But, you know, movies like this, or like Brothers McMullen, you know, I mean, McMullen, if it was released today, would be released this way.
Yes.
You know, and the great thing is, 5 years ago, we didn't have this option, and these movies and, you know, filmmakers like myself were going out of business. With the introduction of, you know, being able to digitally pump a movie into every living room in the country, we're back in business.
And again, on demand, so you don't have to back into a particular week, a particular time.
Exactly.
The Fitzgerald Family Christmas, directed by Ed Burns, and... Well, I suppose as a director and as an actor, you pretty much have, it's your notion, it's your idea that does cover every other aspect of it as well. Filmmaker, producer, director, writer, you name it. I'm delighted to have you back.
Let's make sure it's not another 17 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my very best to your parents.
I will say.
And to your dad. Final question. Is Dad thrilled about this particular aspect of exposure for an Irish-American family again?
You know, we had a screening out on Long Island at a film festival, and that's when my parents saw the film. And during the Q&A, I guess I never mentioned that the father is not based on him or anything like him. And he also, I guess, caught a lot of he got some flack from his friends during McMullen, who thought the father might be based on him as well. So he says, just do me a favor, clear the air with everybody and let them know what a great dad I was. You know, that said, and he knows, I base these terrible fathers on his father. You know, I grew up always hearing what a terrible dad my grandfather was.
And did you know him?
Not really. No. He was gone probably by the time I was six or seven. And he would always talk about it. I'm never going to be the dad that he was. And, you know, you got a sense of what that kind of parenting, how that had an effect on him. So I'm always, you know, that's a big part of what's going on in my head when I sit down and I write these characters.
I'm delighted to have you back.
Thank you very much.
And friends, again, it is the Fitzgerald Family Christmas, Movies On Demand.
iTunes, Amazon,
you name it. And, and it's available right now.
It's available right now.
Ed Burns. Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.